The American government is resilient with a system of checks and balances. The executive, legislative, and judicial branches operate in sync. But this balance wasn't always the case. While the Constitution created the courts, it gave them little power, and they were considered to be lesser than the other two branches of government. In his new book, Without Precedent, Chief Justice John Marshall and His Times, Joel Richard Paul tells the story of how a Virginia frontiersman empowered the judiciary, created judicial review, and helped create a stronger federal government. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm glad it brought Joel Richard Paul to the show. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you so much.
So first, I have to ask you, is this book just a ploy to get a new musical written?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I just turned my previous book, Unlikely Allies, which is the true story of how a merchant, a playwright, and a spy saved the American Revolution. I turned that into a musical, which is we're going to be workshopping next November.
Oh, well, see, there you go. Everybody's all about the almost forgotten historical figures.
But I'm not sure this is a musical.
Well, it's still interesting. So first, I would want to start with, in the book, you write that no member of America's founding generation had a greater impact on the Constitution and the Supreme Court than John Marshall. How was that?
Well, John Marshall joined the court at a time when the court was really under enormous threat from the Jeffersonian crisis. When Jefferson had taken office in 1800, the Republicans swept into Congress. They were seen as revolutionaries who had little respect for the rule of law and for the court system. They wanted to politicize the courts. They wanted to replace all the Federalist judges with their own men. They started impeaching Federalist judges. And John Marshall was a very strategic, pragmatic person who was able somehow to forge a consensus with the members of the court. And he was able, through a number of very strategic moves, to elevate the court's prestige in the eyes of the public and the eyes of Congress to the point where they saw the court as a useful mechanism for maintaining the balance of power. And that was really an enormously creative exercise for a person who really, in some ways, invented the law in much the same way that he invented himself.
Well, okay, so very quickly, I do want to clarify for people. Right. The parties that you're referring to, when you say Republicans, right, we're not talking about the GOP.
We're not talking about the GOP. We're talking about the Jeffersonian Republicans, who were later known as the Democratic Republicans, who were later known as the Democrats. So the Democratic Party today has its roots back at that time.
Okay. All right. Just for clarification.
Yes. Thank you.
but so moving on, what is judicial review, and how did John Marshall able to get that into action?
Right. Good question. So up until this point in time, before John Marshall, the Supreme Court had very little authority. It only decided maybe six cases a year, mostly cases about admiralty law, nothing very controversial. And nobody wanted to be a Supreme Court justice because it was a lousy pay. There was very little prestige. It wasn't anything interesting to decide. And they had to ride circuit, which literally meant getting on a horse and riding around the country, deciding cases in taverns and sleeping with strangers, literally. So the court did not have the kind of prestige and authority it has today. John Marshall really changed all that. One of the things he did was he insisted that all of the justices had to live together. So they all moved to a boarding house together. They ate all their meals together. They lived together without their wives. He was able, through his personality and his intellect, to really get everybody over to his side of the table. Instead of issuing individual opinions, which was the tradition at that time, each judge would issue their own opinion, Marshall got the court to issue unanimous decisions. And over the course of his 34 years on the court, he participated in over 1,100 decisions, more than half of which he personally wrote, and all but 36 of those were unanimous decisions. That's extraordinary.
That's completely unprecedented in today's times. But then again, so are the justices living together.
I'm not sure that would work out today.
I mean, it could answer a lot of problems, but anyway, moving on. He also has this really unique backstory, a Virginia frontiersman who was related to President Jefferson.
That's right. That's right. He was Jefferson's second cousin. He, unlike Jefferson, he grew up in dirt poor on the frontiers of Virginia. His father was a farmer and a surveyor, and Marshall had no formal education apart from a single year of grammar school. He was one of 15 children who shared a two-room log cabin, 400 square feet. That's how he grew up, and yet he was able to educate himself and to emerge as one of the leading attorneys of Virginia at the time, and as Thomas Jefferson's chief rival. And so his cousin Thomas Jefferson, who grew up with this enormous home, with all these privileges, with all these slaves, who had enormous social standing, was Marshall's chief rival in power in Virginia.
I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I am speaking with Joel Richard Paul about his new book, Without Precedent, Chief Justice John Marshall and His Times. Tonight at 7, Joel will be speaking and signing books at the Bryant Park Reading Room in partnership with the New York Historical Society. Up next, attorney Joel... I'm sorry, that was a step too far. I do want to circle back with John's relationship with Thomas Jefferson. Because they were such rivals, you had one who was this actual farmer, this young man who came up living in a, you know, small cramped room, and the other one. How did that then, how did they become nemesis once they became adults? Because it doesn't seem like there was any sort of sense of community or companionship or love between the two of them.
Right, right. No, there was no love between the two of them. In some sense, Jefferson's wealth, his family's wealth, was really acquired because the grandmother of John Marshall, who was in line to inherit this enormous wealth, was disowned by the family. She was kind of a wild woman. And the money instead passed to Jefferson's father, who was not related, actually, but he was a good friend of the brother of Marshall's grandmother. And so Jefferson grows up in this enormous home that used to be the home of Marshall's grandmother, so there was that rivalry. Then Marshall ends up marrying the daughter of the woman who Jefferson first fell in love with, and she looks a lot like her mom, and she had rejected Jefferson's advances. So you can imagine there's a lot of personal animosity there. Jefferson thought that Marshall was kind of like an upstart. He was not worthy to be Jefferson's rival.
Well, it probably also didn't help the way that Marshall even got to the Supreme Court, because I understand Jefferson's even bigger rival was the one who put him there.
Hey, John Adams, right, yeah. Exactly. And the irony of it is that while Jefferson liked to talk a good game of representing the common man, of being a Republican in the sense, not in the sense today, but in the sense then of being an anti-elitist, of being, he was a populist, a guy who got elected based on a southern rural vote, much like someone who recently was elected president, with a lot of racial politics involved. And that, the reality was that it was Marshall who was much more a common man, who was much more the guy who worked his way up in the world and who was an opponent of slavery. And Marshall became a Federalist, which meant that he was really associated with the financial elites. But in the context of that time, that was really a more progressive position, because he believed in urbanization, he believed in modernization, in commerce, in the growth of the country, and in abandoning the agrarian, slave-based economy of the South. And that's really the irony of the story, that Jefferson was not the true Republican. The true Republican was really, I think, John Marshall.
Well, but without giving Marshall a full pass, didn't he also own slaves?
No, he did not have clean hands.
Okay.
He owned slaves. He had 15 household slaves. And but He opposed slavery. He represented slaves in a number of cases pro bono against their masters. As a member of the Virginia State Legislature, he fought for a bill to recognize the citizenship of all Virginians, regardless of race. He also started the Colonization Society in Virginia, which sounds illiberal to our ears, but at the time the notion was to create a homeland for slaves once they were emancipated. And he tried to liberalize the terms of manumission, of ways in which owners could free their slaves. But most importantly, the reason that Marshall fought for a strong national government and for a strong commerce powers given to Congress, his most important contributions were really all about slavery. It was all about the notion of giving Congress the authority, the power that they could eventually use to regulate slavery out of existence. One of his most famous decisions, McCulloch versus Maryland, which involves the authority of Congress to create a national bank, isn't really about a national bank at all. People in their time understood that if Congress had the authority to create a national bank, they would also perhaps have the authority to regulate slavery. And his decision in Gibbons versus Ogden, which asserts the authority of Congress to regulate commerce between the states, is also a case which people, Southerners, condemned at the time because they feared that what he was really doing was he was creating the foundations for Congress to regulate slavery out of existence.
That's, wow. I had no idea that something like that even was the groundwork had been laid. One of the things that I also wanted to ask about Marshall was that his Federalist tendencies were born out of his experiences at Valley Forge.
Yes.
And that seems to be sort of a theme with some of the founding figures.
Yes.
Who, because of what they saw in the Continental Army, was like, no, we need a government that functions.
Exactly. Exactly right. That's right. He was 19 years old when he joined the military. He rose very quickly in the military ranks. When he was at Valley Forge and the men were suffering so terribly, he somehow had the innate resilience. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He would joke about how bad their conditions were. And Washington picked this guy up and made him the chief judge for the army. So even though he had at that time no education and no law school experience, he became the judge advocate general for the army. And he became close friends with Baron von Steuben and with Alexander Hamilton also at Valley Forge. And that really shaped him. And what he saw at Valley Forge was the complete failure of the states, the inability of state government to provide adequately for the army. His cousin Jefferson at the time was governor of Virginia. And Marshall went to his cousin and said, you know, we need more men, we need more military, we need more arms. And Jefferson was too busy preparing to build the new capital, because he was literally designing the capital in Richmond, to bother preparing the state for the eventual invasion of British troops. And so when the British troops invaded, they literally came in, occupied the capital, they took Jefferson's home at Charlottesville. And Marshall was the guy who led the troops to drive the British out of Richmond.
There's so much more of Marshall's story that we could get into, like the fact that he was a diplomat, but I do want to turn to some of his important decisions.
Yes.
And one of them was Marbury versus Madison.
Yes.
First of all, what was that about?
Well, that's a long story, but I'll give you the short version.
Okay.
Marbury versus Madison was basically about, is the case which is often cited for the principle that the Supreme Court can strike down laws of Congress. But it's not really about that, because that principle was not controversial at the time. The case really involves the question as to whether the court can order then Secretary of State James Madison to deliver a commission to this guy, William Marbury. Without getting into all the details of the case, what that case does is it really asserts the authority of Congress to judge the acts of the president and of the Secretary of State and the other members of the cabinet and of the executive branch. Now, think how important that is today. I mean, if Marshall had not asserted that authority today, the Supreme Court would not be able to sit in judgment on the actions of the Trump administration. He really establishes that principle in the case. And James Madison, who after all was the draftsman of the Constitution himself, James Madison didn't agree with Marshall. And Madison didn't even bother showing up in court when he was being sued in this case because he thought the court had no authority over him.
All right. Well, then, speaking of that, that takes us to another important case, Worcester versus Georgia.
Right. Worcester versus Georgia.
Worcester.
Right.
Oh, Worcester. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you're not from Massachusetts.
I so am not. And I wasn't sure. I actually labored over the proper pronunciation. Should I say Worcester or not?
Don't feel badly about that. I would make the same mistake. Worcester versus Georgia was a very important decision in its context. And again, without getting into too much of the detail, it was a case involving the rights of the Indian tribes in Georgia. The tribal nations in Georgia occupied a part of Georgia that in which they had discovered gold, and the white Georgians wanted to push the Indians out and take control of those lands, and they passed a series of laws. And as part of that, some white missionaries from Boston came down and tried to help the Indians and organize the Indians. The missionaries were arrested and actually sentenced to hard labor because no white person was allowed to go into this area. And the case comes before the Supreme Court. And Marshall uses this case as a vehicle to really set out what are the most fundamental principles of Indian tribal law today. The notion that the tribes cannot be subject to the law of the states, that they are independent sovereigns of state control. They can be subject to the control of the federal government, but they cannot be regulated by the states. And that was a very important decision, which, although unfortunately President Jackson refused to comply with the decision.
And that's what really stuck out in my mind was that does the president have the ability to ignore a Supreme Court decision?
Let's hope not. Let's hope
okay,
not.
Okay, well, did Jackson have the ability to do
well,
that?
Well, Jackson ignored it. Jackson ignored the court's decision. Unfortunately, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act that ordered the removal of the Indians by force. They sent in soldiers. Thousands of Indians died in the Trail of Tears. But that decision is still important, and it's important because it created the foundations for tribal law today. Today, when Indians assert their authority to land and to rights under our Constitution, that is protected by Worcester versus Georgia, and that was John Marshall's work. That was his legacy.
So what would you say is Marshall's biggest legacy on the Constitution?
Well, I mean, from my point of view, his most important decisions probably were McCulloch versus Maryland and Gibbons versus Georgia, especially McCulloch versus Maryland, because that's the case in which Marshall famously says that we must never forget it's a constitution we are expounding. And what he meant by that was the Constitution is a living document. It's something which was intended to be a vehicle to move our country forward progressively. Marshall understood that an agrarian slave-based economy could not survive, that industrialization and urbanization and commerce, that was the future. We needed to knit the country together more closely. And Marshall had just incredible vision, and he just saw that all he could do was to sort of lay the seeds of that. But he understood that the Constitution was not stuck in whatever the original intentions were of those white men in an overheated room in Philadelphia in 1789, that it was really something which was a document that had a life of its own, contrary to what the late Justice Scalia said, which was that it was a dead constitution. Scalia famously said that he believed in a dead constitution that was static and never changing. That's not what Marshall believed.
It's a very fascinating story about a very fascinating man. I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I've been speaking with Joel Richard Paul about his new book, Without Precedent, Chief Justice John Marshall and His Times.